From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is on his way to Asia for a trip that'll last nearly 2 weeks. He'll go to Japan and South Korea and then China. That's where we find NPR's Anthony Kuhn in Beijing. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Jeremy.
And Trump's visit comes just after the Chinese President Xi Jinping got a power boost. He got a second five-year term at a recent Communist Party Congress. He said that China wanted to take center stage in the world. What might all of that mean for Trump's visit?
Well, you know, the Party Congress is the political event of the year, and there is a lot of feeling here that China has to get its domestic political agenda in order first before it deals with foreign policy. So the timing on this Trump visit was really crucial. And now that Xi has cemented his position as the strongest leader in decades, we could see him going into this summit with a lot more confidence. During the Party Congress, you know, Xi Jinping suggested in his speeches that China is going to be more proactive in global governance and also in protecting what it considers its rights and interests, its national security. And it looks like it's probably going to do a lot more proposing of its own policies and institutions, such as the new Silk Road plan to link Europe and Asia, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank to fund these sort of projects, and a trade grouping of its own called the Regional Economic Comprehensive Partnership. So while not everyone may like these plans and the fact that China is driving them, since the U.S. pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, the main trade deal in the region, a lot of people in this region just feel like, well, hey, at least China is suggesting some solutions for the region.
Does that new confidence in Beijing also mean it's going to be more difficult for President Trump to get any concessions on trade from China?
The Chinese feel that they've already done a lot on trade, but I think they also have more to offer. And we got a hint of this week. Xi Jinping met with some top foreign CEOs, including Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, Apple's Tim Cook, and others. And what he told them is that China is going to open up even further to the world and to foreign investment. But we'll have to see about that. It's important to remember now, you know, that China does not need as much foreign investment as it used to. China is now investing more than the U.S., and the U.S. invests in China. So it's getting pickier about what it takes. It only wants the things that give it access to good technologies, that don't threaten its environment. And also, you know, China has promised that it's going to steer its economy in a more market-oriented direction. But the jury's still out on that. There are a lot of areas in which it has not delivered on this. And in many ways, the Chinese economy is still very much state-directed, dependent on injections of, state credit for it to grow. And the Chinese government is still very involved in picking economic winners and losers.
Is President Trump likely to address human rights on his visit to China?
You know, rights groups are very vocal right now in calling on President Trump to raise these issues, such as the issue of Liu Xia, who is the widow of the late Nobel Peace Prize laureate Liu Xiaobo, who died in a hospital this year under police custody. But it does not look like the human rights issue is going to get a lot of weight on this visit. Trump administration officials have said that President Trump likes to keep this issue out of the public eye. He likes to conduct this sort of diplomacy very quietly, and so far it generally has.
What do the Chinese people think of President Trump at this point?
Chinese analysts I've spoken to on this issue believe that their government has read Trump pretty accurately and handled the relationship in a way that minimizes risk. When Trump took office, they felt that he threatened to sort of upend the relationship. He had threatened to upgrade relations with Taiwan as a way of pressuring Beijing to make trade concessions. But China called his bluff on this and he backed down. And the way they seem to have approached Trump is to give him face, as they say, to make him look good. They've limited some criticism of Trump in the domestic Chinese press. They handed him some quick deliverables on trade, such as allowing in U.S. beef imports. Of course, they had a lot of FaceTime, including President Xi's visit to Mar-a-Lago in Florida earlier this year. China had a bit of trouble at the beginning figuring out just who was in charge in the Trump administration, who spoke for Trump, who could relay their messages to him. And for a while, they were working with Jared Kushner, a sort of back channel to the White House. Since then, you know, Trump and Xi have developed this personal chemistry, and that Kushner channel doesn't seem quite as important. On the whole, Chinese people feel that Trump is pragmatic and he's not so ideological, not so value-centered as they feared Hillary Clinton might be if she was elected president.
That's NPR's Anthony Kuhn in Beijing as President Trump embarks on his trip to Asia. Anthony, thank you.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
Well, today, President Trump tweeted, "My Twitter account was taken down for 11 minutes by a rogue employee. I guess the word may finally be getting out and having an impact." Well, his Twitter account was temporarily deactivated yesterday, and that lit up social media. Let's bring in Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, for our weekly look at the news through other platforms. Hi, Femi.
Hi there, Robbie.
So at first, Twitter said it was a human error. They got the human part right. Someone did it, you know, kind of a virtual raspberry on their last day of work. Twitter went nuts. Remind us what came up on the president's page.
Well, it depends on what platform that you were reading the president's tweets on. You could have seen at Real Donald Trump, this account doesn't exist. Or sometimes if you're on Twitter, that big blue page where you go to a page that isn't there anymore. And so people on Twitter were reacting to this. Gary Burton says, "The most beautiful moment in history." And then he screen grabbed this section where it says, "At Real Donald Trump doesn't exist." At Kevin Alaba 2, "The best 11 minutes in 4 years." But that tweet that you read out that the president put out a little bit later, once his account was back online, Dr. G responded, "Your account may have been briefly taken down, but your support wasn't. We are still here. Thank you." That's a thank you to the president. I have to say, just watching this reaction, Robin, reminds me that how many people are actually following at Real Donald Trump. They're focused very much on what he's saying, what he's tweeting, and there's real policy and historical records in this Twitter platform that he's using. So the fact that an employee who on his last day or her last day can take it down is really important. I think that's the serious takeaway from what happened for 11 minutes on Thursday.
Well, it's a little scary, you know, because you didn't know why. And, you know, it's a reminder that these are private companies. These aren't public utilities.
Yeah.
You know,
they don't have to keep it there. Yeah,
no,
absolutely.
No.
What a way to go out. And you absolutely cannot be fired for that, can you?
Nope. Fake news is a term that President Trump often tweets. And it was named Word of the Year by the British Collins Dictionary. They released a parody of news anchors on YouTube making the announcement. Let's listen.
Tonight's news stories are
fake. It's fake news.
Okay, a little British humor there. Look, someone's going to do their dissertation on this phrase because it was about a real thing. We've seen the Russian fake news, but then it was co-opted. So you can have fake claims of fake news. What have you found in the reaction to the Collins dictionary choice?
Well, Collins make their choice. They say the choice of our word of the year is always defined by the word that has been most used, really defines the last 12 months. So they said, for once, fake news is legitimate news as it's Collins' word of the year. Molly Goodfellow's response was, "What idiot made fake news the word of the year and not kafefi?" And then I know what you're thinking, everybody. If you're listening to this Collins' word of the year being fake news, Martin Bilam is reading your thoughts. He's challenging you. "I'm going to say this once very clearly, and then we shall never speak of it again. Fake news is a two-word phrase, not a word."
All right. A nitpicker. Look, we've also been following the social media response to billionaire Joe Ricketts, who's founder of TD Ameritrade, shutting down several local news websites that he owns, including Gothamist in New York, after employees voted to unionize. What are you hearing?
Shock. A lot of shock online, and also the practicality, because these local websites came down immediately. And sometimes when a website closes, you can still go back to the website and see all of the content up until the closing date. But the links, the websites, the stories have all gone. Jamel Bovey says, "Joe Ricketts is worth more than $2 billion, but heaven forbid that his employees have a smidgen of economic security." And this goes back to about a week ago when employees at Gothamist were working on getting a union together and unionizing. And Madison says, "If only Joe Ricketts could have scraped together the money to keep Gothamist and DNA Info, two of these websites that are now shuttered, up long enough for writers to save their clips.
Well, yeah, because this is, as somebody tweeted out, let's see, Natalie Solidarity, she tweeted, Ricketts killed hyperlocal Historica archives. No reason other than he didn't want workers expressing autonomy. I mean, this is 9 million readers a month in New York for Gothamist.
It's a really big audience, and it's that question that I know people who are in journalism, who follow journalism, follow news, have been wrestling with. How do you make the news make money, and what happens when it doesn't, but it's still a great source of information for the public? That is part of the problem behind this story.
Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, with just a few of the things that are filtering through social media this week. Femi, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Robin. Take care.
This week, the Civil War returned to the headlines when President Trump's chief of staff, retired General John Kelly, praised Confederate General Robert E. Lee in an interview on Fox News. Kelly said that Lee was a man of his times and spoke about the cause of the war.
Robert E. Lee was an honorable man. He was a man that gave up his country to fight for his state, which in 150 years ago was more important than country. It was always loyalty to state first back in those days. It's different today, but the lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War.
Well, documentary filmmaker Ken Burns tweeted out, there's just one thing that caused the Civil War, slavery. Historians weighed in, said there was nothing but compromise from the country's founding through the 1800s up to the war in 1861. Attempts to appease Southern slave-owning states with compromises, while on the other side of this tug of war, lawmakers who passed laws to try to make slavery an issue of states' rights. Let's get a reminder. David Blight is an historian at Yale University who, happily for us, is organizing a conference at Yale this weekend called Disunion in Civil War America: Parallels for Today. Professor, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Let's dive in. Let's go all the way back to the Constitution, which seemed to compromise. It declared slaves 3/5 a person.
Yes, the problem of slavery was compromised as early as the Constitution. There were 4 or 5 measures in the Constitution, although the word slavery was never used. That's exactly what they were talking about, the 3/5 compromise. There were other elements, the postponing of the issue of the domestic slave trade for 20 years and others. There was the compromise over Missouri in 1820, which was about the admission of the slave state of Missouri. At the same time, they went out and made Maine into a free state.
Okay, so let's get to 1820. It was actually named the Missouri Compromise, again allowing Missouri to come into the Union as a slave-owning state,
right,
but in the process also forbidding that in other territories. This was the rub, wasn't it, that at this time, it was not about telling the South and slave-owning states they couldn't do that, but looking to future territories and trying to stop it from spreading.
Yes. Slavery was already, by 1820, expanding in leaps and bounds. Because of the cotton boom, it would become even greater in the next decade or two. But there were already northern politicians, in this case, namely Rufus King of New York, who took a stand and others followed him and said, okay, Missouri can enter as a slave state, but we're going to balance it with a free state and make Maine into a state. But then, even more importantly, as you just suggested, they drew a line across the continent at the 3630 parallel and said slavery shall never exist north of that line. Now, that was on the books for the next 34 years until it will be eliminated in the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854.
And some are saying that right there, the idea that there was a compromise allowing the southern states to keep their slave-owning traditions. If the South had stayed with that, who knows what might have happened, accepting that compromise. But as you say, 1854, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, this lets states decide the question of slavery. And this is where, a few years later, Lincoln would come in and say, we can't compromise on this.
Right. Well, it's even preceded by the so-called Great Compromise of 1850, which brought the Southwest into the United States. And it created this idea of popular sovereignty, which was The idea of letting the people vote by referendum in a Western territory about whether they would have slavery or not. It gets then superseded by the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which said the people in a Western territory would indeed determine by vote whether slavery shall exist in the West. It opened up the entire West, and some said even the possibility of northern states now, to the legal spread of slavery. Then we had the Dred Scott case of 1857, which in effect declared that the federal government forever, it said, shall not have the power to deny slaveholders the right of possession and transport of their slaves anywhere in the United States. After the Dred Scott case, there was no middle left anymore in American politics, that there were no compromise measures that would work. And this is where Lincoln does come into the picture, of course. That Republican Party that will eventually elect Lincoln by 1860 takes a firm stand against the expansion of slavery anywhere the federal government had jurisdiction. Mm. And that drew a line in the sand that pro-slavery Southerners, most of them Democrats, could not, in their view, tolerate.
Right. Well, and so at this point, we see some of his writing. He's writing to other lawmakers, we will not budge on this. But again, right. He'd been willing, and others had been willing, to allow the southern states to keep it in their area. They refused that compromise. Lincoln then refused to lose the restriction on the expansion. And thank goodness he did.
Yes, in retrospect, thank goodness he did. You see, the essential original compromise here, this is what people need to understand, was a compromise with the Constitution itself, which did protect slaveholding as property rights. They were property under the law of slave states. And the Republicans said, we will not bother you where you already own slaves in your own states, but we will stop its expansion in the West. Now, the problem with that idea is that Southerners, pro-slavery Southerners, quite rightly interpreted that the following way. They said to stop or to condemn slavery anywhere is to condemn it everywhere. They believed that if you're condemning slavery in the Western territories and you're saying the American future cannot have slave labor, you're morally condemning it where it already exists. And too many of them who became secessionists said they could not live in the same union with an anti-slavery political coalition that seemed, in their view, to be on a hell-bent course to destroy their labor system, their economy, their way of life.
Look, your conference this weekend is subtitled Parallels for Today.
With a question mark.
Yeah. Oh, okay, good. So you're not declaring, you're asking.
Well, no, you got to be careful with analogies and parallels. Yeah. We want to keep the question mark in there.
Are there? I mean, some are saying there is, again, no middle ground in the U.S.
Yeah, well, we're running out of a middle. That's true. Well, there are parallels, and this is what we're going to take up in this conference. We're not suggesting that these analogies are direct by any means, but America had a huge problem in the 1850s with nativism. With immigration, had a huge problem with nationalism, pro-slavery nationalism and anti-slavery nationalism. It had a huge issue in defining what is an American. It had a massive problem of race and slavery and trying to define the American future. And perhaps above all to this issue of disunion, it had a political party system tearing itself apart. And this in particular is something we want to look closely at, because the American political party system right now is not in good health. There's all kinds of talk about, where are the third parties? Where are the resistance parties? Where are the anti-Trump Republicans going? And we have a very restricted history of third parties in this country. But the one time in American history when a brand new political party came into existence and then won the presidency within 6 years was the Republican Party of the 1850s. It is the model. It's the story we have to look at to try to understand whether something like that is beginning to happen again.
Well, and it was an anti-slavery party.
It was.
Yeah.
But it was a party that was a motley coalition, by the way, but it was dedicated to stopping the expansion of slavery into America's future. That sufficiently threatened enough Southerners that they seceded from the Union and they cast their lot in an attempt to create a separate country.
By the
which
way,
General Kelly called honorable.
Well, you say his words, including talking about the statues as being, you know, reflective of that mm-hmm. time. We know most of the sure. Confederate-era statues weren't put up till the early 1900s, and it was
right.
about rolling back some of the mm-hmm. advances. But you say these words are part of a reconciliationist tradition that absolves yeah. everyone of responsibility. What do you mean by that?
Well, General Kelly's comments are rooted in an understanding of American history that was popular essentially in the 1940s and 50s. It's that old. And for two and three generations, historians have exploded it and tried to wash it out of the American consciousness, and we've obviously failed. This is the idea that both sides fought for noble ends. Both sides were honorable in their conscience and in their pursuits, that Southern slaveholders and Southern officers who bolted from the Union were going with their states out of honor rather than their country, as the general just said. And in the end, if you believe this approach, this kind of sentimentalized, romanticized approach to Civil War memory, then nobody's really responsible. And in the end, we don't have to deal with what the war was truly, really about, which was slavery and then the aftermath of the emancipation of 4 million slaves and the redefinition of an American republic.
That's David Blight, historian at Yale University. And again, their conference this weekend is called Disunion in Civil War America, Parallels for Today? We'll link you to more at herenow.org. Professor, to be a fly on that wall, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
NPR CEO Jarl Mohn met with NPR staff this afternoon to discuss his decision this week to ask for the resignation of Senior Vice President for News Michael Oreskes. Oreskes' resignation came after allegations of sexual harassment before his time at NPR and during his tenure at the network. Yesterday, Mohn wrote an email to the staff in which he said he let staff down in his handling of the concerns about Oreskes' behavior toward women. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik has been covering this story, and he joins us from New York. David, you recused yourself from listening in on this staff meeting since it was designated off the record, but what have you been able to learn?
So, you know, you talk to a huge room in news, of reporters, and people can serve as sources as well
right.
as reporters. I talked to a lot of folks in the room as it was happening. Mohn apologized again very directly. He sounded contrite. I think my sense is that he was more concrete than he has been in recent days. He especially singled out the women in the workforce and said, I should have acted sooner and should have acted more forcefully. He acknowledged he should have conducted a full investigation after complaints of Oreskes' behavior at the New York Times was lodged. These were for events that happened nearly two decades ago, but these complaints registered by women to NPR first in October of 2016 and then again last month. He didn't do that. This time he's committing to an independent investigation by a law firm that doesn't usually do business with NPR. He wants to encourage employees to join a committee he'd like to set up to hear complaints, a tip line, better training. He said, and this is the tenor of a lot of what he said, our intention was honorable and our execution poor, and he wanted to learn from it by engaging the workforce rather than sort of saying exactly what will happen next.
I've spoken to somebody who was listening in on this meeting, and this person described a lot of anger on the part of NPR staff.
Yeah, there were some folks who said quite explicitly to Mohn they had lost faith in his leadership. Others said that they wanted him, including Nina Totenberg, one of our most senior correspondents, said that you know, she didn't want this to cost Jarl Mohn her job. But there were a lot of folks who talked about their heartbreak and distress about this being allowed to roil within NPR in the way it did, that women on the workforce were essentially put at risk of deeply inappropriate behavior that became harassing. You know, one of the things I reported this morning on Morning Edition was that two veteran editors were so concerned about the climate of distrust of Oreskes by their women colleagues, their female colleagues, that they went to HR and said there was a toxic newsroom. And one of those two editors told HR that that he had lost the newsroom. He had lost the ability to lead. Those are strong signs. He did that in these two editors did that in late September of 2016. You know, Mike Oreskes wasn't put on leave until after the Washington Post reported about these two women's complaints from the events dating back, nearly two decades. The institution had a lot of time to act in between those two events, and it didn't.
Now, NPR is governed by a board that includes representatives from member stations. Are they playing a role here?
Well, the timeline that I've been given is that they were first informed of complaints against Mike Oreskes, which included an internal complaint from one of our younger and more junior colleagues as far back as October 2015, right. That they were informed just last month, the chairman and the vice chairman, and that the full board was only informed on Halloween, that is this past Tuesday, as Oreskes was about to be put on leave. They are absolutely being consulted. They'll get to pick who investigates what happened and what went wrong.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik on the news at NPR. David, thank you.
You bet.
And let's take a deeper look now at the Republican plan to cut taxes. It's an ambitious proposal that will cost $1.5 trillion over the next decade. It'll slash the corporate tax rate, eliminate the estate tax for wealthy families, reduce the number of tax brackets from 7 to 4, and limit a popular deduction for homeowners. Lawmakers are betting the changes will jumpstart economic growth and new jobs, but there are big questions about that. Joining us now on Skype is George Yin, professor of law and taxation at the University of Virginia. He's also the former chief of staff for the U.S. Congress Joint Committee on Taxation, and he served on the majority Republican staff in the Senate Finance Committee during the last major rewrite of the tax code. That was back in the 80s. Professor Yin, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
First of all, how does this compare with what Republicans did back in the 80s?
It's in some respects, the bill does resemble the 1980s effort. I would say one of the big differences is the process they're going through. The 80s was much more transparent compared with the process that they're using right now.
And what does that tell you?
Well, I think it's partly a change of the era. So 30 years ago, it was conceivable that there were more moderate members of Congress who were willing to reach compromises and so forth. In today's world, it seems like there's much more polarization. And so the majority party just feels like they can act without serious discussion on the part of the full Congress.
Well, one of the knocks on this plan already is that it is really a tax cut for the wealthy and not for the middle class. What's your take on that?
Well, I actually was very surprised when I looked at the bill, considering it's been described as a massive tax cut for the middle class and considering that it is estimated to cost $1.5 trillion over 10 years, I was surprised how little of the tax savings actually ends up going to the middle class. In fact, by my calculations, there's an important segment of middle class taxpayers, single people with income between $45,000 and $90,000, and joint filers with income between $90,000 and $150,000, people that are squarely in the middle class or maybe the upper middle class. Some important number of them, I think, are vulnerable not only to not getting a tax cut, but actually are going to experience a tax increase from this bill. Essentially, the people most vulnerable will be people who have either no children in their home or their children are grown, and they live in a relatively high tax state. For those numbers of people, and there's a lot of people that would qualify for, those terms, I think it's quite likely they will be experiencing a tax increase rather than any tax cut at all.
Let's talk about the corporate tax cut. The rate would drop for corporations from 35 to 20% on the promise that that is going to make the U.S. much more competitive globally. Is that your view of what that will do?
Well, I think the studies are mixed on that. Some people certainly make the argument that a lower tax rate will bring more capital into the United States and therefore increase labor productivity and essentially, you know, raise all boats. Other studies are much less optimistic about that. You know, a lot depends on factors that we can't control. For example, if we drop our corporate tax rate, and every other country in the world doesn't make any change, well, that would be one set of circumstances. But as we discovered back in 1986, when we did drop the corporate tax rate very significantly, in fact, more significantly than what is proposed here, every other country basically followed suit and, in fact, in many cases, even drop their rate even further below ours. And so the effect of whatever we hope to accomplish from that was very much muted by the response of the rest of the world. And we of course, have no way of predicting what the rest of the world will do, and we have no control over what they will do.
One of the deductions that's gotten a lot of attention is the mortgage interest deduction, and they're proposing in this plan a change to it so that it would be eliminated for loans over $500,000 as opposed to $1 million. What do you think the effect of that will be? The housing industry is very upset about it.
Yeah, well, that's clearly going to have an effect on the housing industry. You know, I think that there certainly are arguments that current law has been too favorable to housing in general. That said, we have had those laws, and they have bolstered the industry and bolstered the property values of many homeowners. And so, you know, there is an issue about whether by making some of these dramatic changes, you are going to be hurting property values and therefore hurting current homeowners, as well as diminishing the benefits available to future homeowners. The item that you mentioned is actually just one of a number of items that are going to affect homeowners. Many of your listeners are probably familiar with the fact that under current law, almost all homeowners don't have to pay any tax when they sell their principal residence. Under this bill, they actually would phase that benefit out for upper income taxpayers. That's something that I don't think has been noted yet. What that means is, of course, upper income taxpayers are going to be affected by that. But that also could have a ripple effect in the housing industry generally. To the extent upper income taxpayers become less mobile because they don't want to sell their homes because they're going to have to pay tax on their sales, then that could have a certain effect in the industry generally. So there are a lot of issues that are really unclear at this point.
Professor, we just spent a week in Kansas where they instituted tax cuts several years ago. They really caused problems in the state's economy, for the state's budget, for school funding, etc. Republicans in that state ended up overriding the governor's veto and removing many of the tax cuts. And a lot of people there were saying, well, this is very similar to what is being proposed in Washington. Now that we have these details, what do you think? Should lawmakers in Washington be looking at what happened in Kansas before they pass any tax cuts?
Well, I think it certainly is useful information to study what happened in Kansas. There are some corollaries between what they did and what is being proposed in this bill. There are also some obviously big differences. That's just one state, and there are differences between how capital flows and so forth are going to be affected by a change in a given state's tax system versus a change in the federal system. So, you know, I don't pretend to suggest that we should necessarily look at their experience as definitive to what would happen in the U.S., but I certainly think it is a very instructive recent experience that we should be looking at very closely.
Do you expect that something close to what was proposed yesterday will pass in the end?
I am pretty skeptical. I understand very much the need of the proponents to try to carry out a very quick process to prevent this special interest from essentially nibbling away at the bill until they, you know, kill the bill. But what they perhaps are overlooking here is that this bill is so huge, it affects virtually all Americans and all businesses. And it just seems in that situation very important to know how it's going to actually affect those people and those businesses. I also think, frankly, it's good politics to slow down and think about those issues. If they were to pass the bill in this very expedited fashion, there will undoubtedly be a number of surprises and unintended effects that will be discovered after the bill is passed. And at that point, the American people who are affected are going to clearly know who to blame for this, because they will have on record who voted for this legislation. I think that if I were in Congress right now, I would not be supporting a very expedited process. I think I would very much encourage Congress to slow down and try to make sure they understand what's actually in this bill.
That's George Yin, who is a professor of law and taxation at the University of Virginia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
The New York Times reported this week that the man charged in the New York truck attack had ISIS phrases such as "it will endure" on paper and cell phones found at the scene. In 2016, an ISIS magazine instructed truck attackers to leave those kinds of messages. And this week, an ISIS newsletter claimed the Manhattan attacker was a soldier. But did he communicate with the group or just read its magazine? And how has ISIS's vast communication network changed after its de facto capital, Raqqa in Syria, was taken back by American-backed forces last month? Mina Alami studies jihadi media at BBC Monitoring, which monitors media. Mina, what have you seen?
Well, we have noticed a significant drop in ISIS media output since the fall of Raqqa. And we're talking about, you know, from an average of 20 to 30 unique media items per day through IS's official channels on Telegram, down to 10 or less items per day.
What do you think that means?
Well, I think one thing is that a significant part of IS's media operation was actually based in Raqqa. We were never sure, of course, that was kind of the indication that it was based there, as well as possibly in Mosul in Iraq. But I think with the fall of Raqqa, we found, for example, that two of IS's flagship products have disappeared. First and foremost is its radio station called Al Bayan, and that was based, it used to transmit from Mosul in Iraq and Raqqa in Syria. In order to have wider reach, IS used to offer its radio broadcast as podcasts in multiple languages, including in English and Russian and French. This was a key feature of its daily propaganda that has been going since April 2015. And since the 25th of October, these broadcasts, these podcasts stopped.
Well, you sent us a podcast episode from IS's station, Al Bayan. Let's listen to some of it.
In East Asia, the soldiers of the Khilafah killed three soldiers of the Crusader Filipino Army during clashes in the neighborhood of Baling, and also sniped and killed a fourth crusader in the neighborhood of Marionat in the city of Marawi.
So, Mina, what's going on here? Is it just a laundry list?
So what we were listening to was an IS, alleged IS presenter reading out news of the past 24 hours. And he's talking about the various IS's so-called provinces. And these are openly available on the messaging app Telegram. So they're not in some kind of dark web part of the internet. They are not very difficult to access. Actually, IS, so the majority of its operation lives on the messaging app Telegram. A lot of these, what they call channels, or they're basically accounts on Telegram, are public, so they're open to anyone who wants to access them. Of course, there are a lot of efforts from Telegram and all these social media companies to suspend these accounts, but they just keep on re-emerging.
Does it really matter that there aren't new missives? As you said, it's down from like 30 to maybe 10 a day. If there's so much out there, we spoke of the accused truck attacker in New York, his cell phone filled with videos. Those videos are already out there.
Absolutely. And I think one of the kind of the key mission of the, you know, the army of IS supporters online is actually to amplify that message. Yes, their accounts get suspended eventually, but that's it. The message is out there.
Well, what happened to, for instance, the official magazine or official comments? We know that ISIS was a little slow in claiming the attack in New York. Was that because maybe some of their communication is also cut off?
I don't think the late claim for the New York truck attack was anything to do with the interruption of its media operation. The central media, as well as its so-called news agency, Amaq, they're still active. They're still putting out material. The thing is that IS typically doesn't claim attacks when the perpetrator is arrested, when he's caught alive, basically, simply because in that case, they might either harm the person even more by claiming, you know, association, mm-hmm. or the, you know, the suspect could then, you know, turn around and deny any knowledge or can contradict the IS claim. Mm-hmm. However, my opinion personally, in this instance, they waited for news to trickle from mainstream media. Now, the suspect continued, even after his arrest, continued to kind of show some kind of loyalty or allegiance to IS. So I think with that, it was kind of like a sign to IS, say, okay, we're not going to harm him even further, so we need to claim this. Mm. However, it's worth mentioning that the claim did not come out through its central channels on Telegram. Instead, they featured it lower down in its weekly magazine, An-Neba. And I think that's kind of, they try to get around the delay, the hesitance, by saying, well, An-Neba, the magazine, it's a roundup anyway of events of the week, so that's fine to feature it there.
However, there was another magazine, Rumia, that hasn't been published. The first time that skipped a publication.
Absolutely. And this is, you know, this is crucial because the core of Rumia is, you know, to incite attacks, lone actor attacks in the West. And its October edition did not materialize. The group hasn't said anything about the absence there, nor have its supporters.
What's your take on what happens because some of these communications have been reduced?
I think, first of all, I mean, it does seem to be a clear kind of effect from losing Raqqa before Mosul. Now it's kind of reports today that they've lost the city of Deir ez-Zor. So no doubt this will have an impact on their media operation. However, I think that this does not definitely spell the demise of IS's media operation. If anything, as it's losing territory, it actually needs to stay alive and alive through that media operation.
Mina Alami of BBC Monitoring. They analyze communications around the world. Mina, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.